Chapter 7. The Good Book and the Changing Moral Zeitgeist.
Politics has slain its thousands, but religion has slain its tens of thousands. Sean O'Casey.
There are two ways in which scripture might be a source of morals or rules for living. One is by direct instruction, for example through the Ten Commandments, which are the subject of such bitter contention in the culture wars of America's boondocks. The other is by example. God or some other biblical character might serve as, to use the contemporary jargon, a role model. Both scriptural roots, if followed through religiously, the adverb is used in its metaphoric sense but with an eye to its origin, encourage a system of morals which any civilized modern person, whether religious or not, would find, I can put it no more gently, obnoxious. To be fair, much of the Bible is not systematically evil, but just plain weird, as you would expect of a chaotically cobbled-together anthology of disjointed documents, composed, revised, translated, distorted, and improved by hundreds of anonymous authors, editors, and copyists, unknown to us and mostly unknown to each other, spanning 9 centuries. This may explain some of the sheer strangeness of the Bible, but unfortunately, it is this same weird volume that religious zealots hold up to us as the inerrant source of our morals and rules for living. Those who wish to base their morality literally on the Bible have either not read it or not understood it, as Bishop John Shelby Spong in The Sins of Scripture rightly observed. Bishop Spong, by the way, is a nice example of a liberal bishop whose beliefs are so advanced as to be almost unrecognizable to the majority of those who call themselves Christians. A British counterpart is Richard Holloway, recently retired as Bishop of Edinburgh. Bishop Holloway even describes himself as a recovering Christian. I had a public discussion with him in Edinburgh, which was one of the most stimulating and interesting encounters I've had.
The Old Testament. Begin in Genesis with the well-loved story of Noah, derived from the Babylonian myth of Utnapishtim, and known from the older mythologies of several cultures. The legend of the animals going into the ark two by two is charming, but the moral of the story of Noah is appalling. God took a dim view of humans, so he, with the exception of one family, drowned the lot of them, including children, and also, for good measure, the rest of the presumably blameless animals as well. Of course, irritated theologians will protest that we don't take the book of Genesis literally anymore. But that is the whole point. We pick and choose which bits of scripture to believe, which bits to write off as symbols or allegories. Such picking and choosing is a matter of personal decision, just as much or as little as the atheist's decision to follow this moral precept or that was a personal decision, without an absolute foundation. If one of these is morality flying by the seat of its pants, so is the other. In any case, despite the good intentions of the sophisticated theologian, a frighteningly large number of people still do take their scriptures, including the story of Noah, literally. According to Gallup, they include approximately 50% of the US electorate. Also, no doubt, many of those Asian holy men who blamed the 2004 tsunami not on a plate tectonic shift, but on human sins, ranging from drinking and dancing in bars to breaking some footling Sabbath rule. Steeped in the story of Noah and ignorant of all except biblical learning, who can blame them? Their whole education has led them to view natural disasters as bound up with human affairs, paybacks for human misdemeanors, rather than anything so impersonal as plate tectonics. By the way, what presumptuous egocentricity to believe that earth-shaking events, on the scale at which a god or a tectonic plate might operate, must always have a human connection. Why should a divine being, with creation and eternity on his mind, care a fig for petty human malefactions? We humans give ourselves such airs, even aggrandizing our pokey little sins to the level of cosmic significance.
When I interviewed for television the Reverend Michael Bray, a prominent American anti-abortion activist, I asked him why evangelical Christians were so obsessed with private sexual inclinations, such as homosexuality, which didn't interfere with anybody else's life. His reply invoked something like self-defense. Innocent citizens are at risk of becoming collateral damage when God chooses to strike a town with a natural disaster because it houses sinners. In 2005, the fine city of New Orleans was catastrophically flooded in the aftermath of a hurricane, Katrina. The Reverend Pat Robertson, one of America's best-known televangelists and a former presidential candidate, was reported as blaming the hurricane on a lesbian comedian who happened to live in New Orleans. You'd think an omnipotent God would adopt a slightly more targeted approach to zapping sinners, a judicious heart attack, perhaps, rather than the wholesale destruction of an entire city